The Laura Murphy Show, Episode 11.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everyone. This is the Laura Murphy Show, episode number 11. We're back from a brief hiatus. Carlos, you're back safe and sound in your studio.
I am.
Great. We put a replay of a speech that I had given last week as Carlos was traveling, but now we're both back in the saddle and we're here to give you more information, financial analysis from the perspective of Austrian economics and the infinite banking concept. That's what the Laura Murphy Show is all about. So for this particular episode, what we're going to do, folks, is talk about the national debt. This was a recommendation from one of our listeners saying that this is, I'm a smart guy, I know this kind of stuff, but, you know, I've never really gotten my mind wrapped around this issue of the national debt, so can you and Carlos tackle this subject? So that's what we're here to do. And by the way, if any of you also have recommendations, please go ahead and send them to us. Remember, you can reach Carlos or me at the website contact form. Just go to laramurphy.com, and then you'll see at the top to the right, there's going to be a Contact Us tab. So why don't I let you start things off, Carlos? Is there anything you want to say in terms of just setting the table before we dive into this?
Well, you know, Bob, when you start talking about the national debt, you can start talking about a lot of things that I think are pretty scary. A lot of these things can be very depressing to our listeners as they hear us talk about some of these things. And it makes sense to me at some point before we let the listeners go today that we at least lay out some sort of a practical strategy that they can do, because as they hear us talk about these things, I know that question is going to come up in their minds. You know, what can we do? Is there anything that we can do based on what you're talking about? So if we can make a little pact between you and I and say that as we see the time approaching at the end, let's sort of end this thing with some solid information for them that they can actually take some action and help themselves out.
Okay. I assume it's going to be beyond Jim Beam and Jack Daniels.
Yes, absolutely. And then the other thing that in setting the table, I would say that because we're looking at this from the Austrian School of Economics, I mean, it's just a whole different way of looking at the economy, at our whole political system, our government. And if you can go into this particular view, it's not long before you realize, you say, you know, this is really common sense economics. This is the kind of stuff my grandfather used to talk about. But we're in a world of Keynesian economics, and a lot of this stuff is, in my opinion, especially when we talk about the national debt, it's just absolutely crazy. I would like to lead off, Bob, by just simply saying that it's important for the listener at least to accept this truth. And that is that the government doesn't have any money, period. I mean, it can only spend, you know, what it takes from us as taxpayers. So if they can just sort of settle in with that truth, I think then we can begin to talk about this national debt. You know, the government does not have any money. It can only spend what it can take from us in taxes. And the thing about it is they spend a lot of money, a lot of money. And as we zero in at what the national debt is as of April 2016, we see that it's sitting up there at $19.3 trillion. And that's a combination of federal, state, and local. And that is the first thing I want to say. The number is huge. It's staggering. And that's where we are.
Okay. Well, thank you, Carlos. Let me also warm people up with some introductory remarks to sort of frame these issues. One thing is, this is pretty basic, but I remember when I was younger and starting to really start reading these figures and try to make sense of them all. One thing I want to stress is the distinction between the deficit and the overall debt. Sometimes you'll see people use the terms interchangeably, but they're actually not. So the deficit is a flow figure. And what that means is, for a given period of time, what is the excess of spending over revenues? And whereas the debt is like a static concept, all right? It's not a flow, it's a stock variable, if you're familiar with the distinction between flows and stocks. So loosely speaking, if you add up all the deficits through history, then that will give you, at the end of that exercise, what the total outstanding debt is at that period. So if you started out and you were $1 trillion in debt and then you ran a $100 billion deficit, you would end up $1.1 trillion in debt at the end of that time period, if that makes sense to people. So the deficit at any given period reflects how much deeper is the government going into debt, whereas the debt is like the accumulation of all past deficits to that point. And by the same token, even if the government's running a surplus, so some folks may remember, like during the Clinton administration, there were a couple years there where, at least according to the official figures, the U.S. federal government was running a budget surplus. The U.S. government was still very deeply in debt. It's just the outstanding amount of debt was going down during those two periods. So that's the distinction at that level. I also want to make sure everyone understands what Carlos was meaning there. He's saying that, for example, a private business, they're actually generating net value for their customers, if you will, or for society at large. And I'm speaking loosely here, that they are, you know, it's a productive enterprise. As long as it's profitable, it's generating net income. And so a corporation can issue bonds to bridge a cash flow gap in a certain period if they need to spend more money than they have cash coming in the door. But over time, when you ask, how can they service those bonds? How can they pay interest to the bondholders or ultimately retire that debt? Where is that going to come from? The answer is, well, as long as it's a successfully run company and the people are in a, you know, good industry, then they're going to come from creating value to their customers and in excess of the materials they use up, and that's where it's going to come from. In contrast, the U.S. government, it also issues bonds to bring in revenue from lenders or to be able to spend beyond its means. But when you say, well, where's the money going to come from down the road to service that debt, Carlos's point is, it's not because the U.S. government is creating all this net value for everybody and they're willingly paying for its services. No, the government ultimately gets the money that it uses to service debt through taxation. It also complicates things to bring in the printing press, but for this episode, let's not worry so much about inflation because that's sort of an indirect tax, but let's just focus on assuming that, you know, the Fed is kind of just sitting there and holding the supply of dollars constant to at least focus on this issue of taxation and debt.
Well, one thing that you're bringing up there, and it's very important, which I would say is the second big point to understand, not only does the government not have any money of its own and that it can only spend what it can take from us in taxes, there's another truth that I think our listeners need to embrace, and that is that our money is not really in our control. And what I mean by that is that our money is sort of like in a box. You know, yes, we all have a certain amount of money that we earn, and some of us earn more money than others, but it is in a box in that, in actuality, our money is really owned by the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve is where we get our monetary policy from. They have control over our money. in that no matter where, you know, in what form our money appears, it gets denominated back to these green pieces of paper that we all have. All we have to look at is look at the any one of our dollars and see that it says Federal Reserve note. So in one sense, we've got the Federal Reserve that has complete control over our money, and all this is mandated, you know, by our government. Now, our government controls us as well, again, through in two forms. One is through regulation. We call it government intervention in our life, almost in every aspect of our life. And then again, also through taxation. So through these means, both what the government does and the Federal Reserve does, we see that we only have limited control of our money. And so as Bob was alluding to, the issuing of bonds, which is basically an IOU, all of this is actually perpetuated by our government in a joint venture with the Federal Reserve. So when we talk about this huge national debt, in a sense, we really don't have any control over it. They actually are the ones that are perpetuating it.
Yeah, that's part of what's amazing about this, is that they're, in a sense, issuing these bonds that are going to be ultimately financed by future taxpayers, and we have very limited control over that. Why don't we, before we sort of dwell too much on the significance of it, though, I really want to make sure people understand the mechanics. Like, what do you mean the debt? And so here, again, think of a corporation first, because the mechanics, at least at this level of analysis, are the same. That you can imagine a company, and they want to build a new factory. They need $100 million to do it. And for various reasons, either they don't have the cash flow to finance it, or they just would prefer not to tinker with that. They want to bring in the extra financing to make this new factory by going deeper into debt. And so they issue bonds. The company does. Bondholders, investors out in the community, voluntarily give them $100 million collectively to get these pieces of paper issued by the company that says, down the road, we will pay the owner of this IOU such and such amount of money. And so the total amount that those bonds promise to pay is going to be bigger than $100 million, right? Because there's going to be an implicit interest return or yield on those corporate bonds. So that is the mechanism, and that's how you see the sense in which, you know, debt financing works and where the interest comes in, that ultimately the company is going to have to pay more than $100 million in order to get these pieces of paper out of circulation. So now people walking around the community don't have obligations or claims against that company. All right. So, and again, the mechanism is, for example, the company might issue a bond that says 10 years from now, the owner of this is going to get paid $1,000 from the company. And maybe right now an investor will only have to pay $990 to get that piece of paper, right? So the company is going to have to issue a greater amount of future payments in order to raise the $100 million spot today. And that gap, that discount, reflects the fact that there's a positive interest rate or yield embedded in that transaction. And so, you know, is debt finance good or bad? Well, it depends. You know, there's differences of opinion, and there's different circumstances under which it might make perfect sense for a company to do that. Just like, you know, is it bad for a young couple to take out a mortgage to buy a house? Well, people have different viewpoints on that, but a lot of Americans think, well, no, as long as they don't pay something too extravagant, you know, yeah, in general, the idea of buying a house with some financing, yeah, maybe it's not a big deal. There's certainly a qualitative difference between buying a house with a mortgage versus like using credit cards to finance a trip to Tahiti, right? People can see, okay, yeah, there's differences there. And certainly there's a big difference between a company financing the construction of a new factory that they think is going to bring in more than enough to finance the debt and pay it off than some company that's in big financial trouble just borrowing money to roll over other debts and so on. All right. So in general, the mechanics there are the same. When the U.S. government or state and local governments want to spend more in a given period than they have in incoming tax revenue and other forms of income, then they issue bonds. And it's the same principle. The bonds promise that the government will pay the holder of the bond a certain amount down the road and how much you have to lend the government today to get your hands on that is a smaller number. And that gap, again, reflects the positive interest rate. And so that's why, if you think about it, once there's a given amount of outstanding debt, people walking around holding treasury securities, for example, things issued by the U.S. Treasury saying the owner of this piece of paper is owed such and such dollars by the U.S. government on this date, just to roll that over, even if the government started balancing its books going forward and had neither a budget surplus nor a budget deficit, and just every year would pay out what it was taking in terms of tax revenue, so it had a balanced budget, there would still be positive costs of servicing that debt. It would, you know, part of the budget just to stay even would be going to service the existing level of debt because of the positive interest. So as the amount of those bonds came due and the government wanted to roll it over and just borrow money from others to keep that total level of debt outstanding, it would be able to borrow less from outsiders than it owed to the existing people. And so that gap would be the interest payment, right? So it's the same principle, just like if you were a household and you had a credit card debt and you just wanted to keep, you know, oh, I owe Visa right now $5,000. I can't pay them off right now. Let me just keep making the minimum payments to keep it at $5,000, but I'm not running up more charges. You know, I'm not going to the store and putting more stuff on my Visa. I'm just paying what I need to keep the thing rolling over at $5,000. Well, that would cost you money, right? The interest, the finance charges, even just to keep the thing level, would be taking a bite out of your salary. And so the same thing is true for governments, that of the existing tax revenue coming in, the bigger the outstanding stock of the debt, the bigger the finance charges or the interest costs, meaning that money that's coming in, they can't use it for roads or schools or the military or pensions for retired government employees. They have to just pay it as interest to people who own treasury securities. So that's one way of seeing, you know, what's the impact, what's the problem if the debt gets to be too big. It's that even if the government's able to finance it and there's not like a crisis, nonetheless, that means a larger share of the existing tax revenues gets absorbed just by paying interest expenses on the current level of the debt.
Yeah. Okay. Now, let me take a shot at trying to simplify it a little bit, because everything that you said, Bob, is absolutely correct. Maybe perhaps we think about it in terms of governments wanting to go to war. War is very expensive. So if you even think even of the United States at the time that maybe it was going into World War I, here's Congress trying to balance their budget, and they've got to raise money to go to war. And so, as Bob's saying, they will issue a bond, like a war bond, and sell it to individuals and or institutions, which is a way of borrowing money from those that are willing to pay the government, you know, so that the government has the money to go to war. As we study the United States, we see that concept, that idea, that every time Congress gets to the end of the year and it's trying to balance their budget, all the taxes, you know, have been collected and they're short. And so what they usually say, and it's usually around Christmas time, is why don't we just issue another bond? Why don't we just borrow again on taxpayer money, you know, for the future? And so this kind of strategy, you know, has been going on for quite some time. And when we hear people say our government is bankrupt, it is simply because they have been using this strategy over and over again. And along the way, they have created all kinds of what people refer to as entitlement programs, which is a funny term because no one's entitled to anything. I mean, but when we think of Social Security, it's an entitlement program. When we think of Medicare, it's an entitlement program. Food stamps is another entitlement program. As we have less and less producers in our economy, these entitlement programs become necessary and they have to be kept up, but they're very expensive. So the issuance of bonds or borrowing on future taxpayer money continues. We have unemployment benefits. We have Fannie Mae. We have Freddie Mac. The funding for space travel, the war on terror, the war on drugs. In fact, just the military, period, is a huge expense. The government has, what, Bob, 3 million employees, and half of them, you know, are armed to the teeth with the finest weaponry that money can buy. All of this costs money, and they have to be kept up. And so this is why the issuing of these bonds has continued, and this is why we're sitting with $19.3 trillion, you know, in a total national debt.
Yeah, you raise a lot of good points. And this is a good segue because I wanted to make some distinctions. You brought up entitlement spending. If you dive into a lot of these official budget analyses, things from like the Congressional Budget Office and their projections of, you know, here's what's going to happen over the next 30 years, blah, blah, blah. They do make these distinctions between what Carlos was calling entitlement spending on the one hand versus what they might call discretionary spending. So the idea is, I mean, ultimately, the government can do what it wants. And if it decides to say, hey, you know what, we're not paying Medicare anymore, I mean, I guess there'd be riots in the street, but they have the legal ability to do that. But there's a sense in which the government owes Social Security retirees the money they thought they were getting, right? That they believe in a sense that their pension, if you will, is there because they've been paying into Social Security thinking they were going to get benefits at a certain level. Same thing with Medicare. They've been having stuff deducted from their paychecks their whole working career to fund these programs, thinking, you know, with the ostensible guarantee that, hey, we're doing this because you're too stupid or you lack the foresight to do it yourself. And so that's why the government's going to be here, because we know if you get to be 70 years old and you're destitute, we're not going to stand idly by as a society and let you die in the streets. And so since we're going to be on the have that obligation anyway to take care of you, we're going to force you on the front end to contribute to it. And that's the whole rationale for these social safety net or social insurance programs. But there's a sense in which the government, you know, they're more tied into having to pay those things going forward, as opposed to in the year 2040, does the government have to give Boeing a contract for more jets for the military? There's a sense in which that's much more discretionary, if you will, than the entitlements. So when you can break down the figures, and that's what you'll see in terms of some of these budget documents. That's the distinction they're making. Now, let me throw some numbers out here just so people have an idea and get their bearings, because you might say, okay, well, Carl's just gave us one number, but that was for federal, state, and local. I looked up, the latest number I could see is the federal debt held by the public, and this was as of fourth quarter 2015. That was about $13.7 trillion. Okay, so the number Carlos was giving was bigger. For one thing, it was a little bit later. His numbers are more recent than the one I gave, but also his was including the explicit amount that state governments and local governments owe to people, whereas the number I just gave was the federal government. But also, there's another distinction of the total outstanding federal debt, which is bigger. So you might have remembered those battles over the debt ceiling. In going into the last negotiations that were made in the fall of 2015, the federal debt limit was $18.1 trillion. And so you might say, well, wait a minute. If it was $18.1 trillion and they were running around with Boehner with his last deal to avert a crisis, how could the federal debt owed to the public only be $13.7 trillion a month later? Well, there's a distinction there. It's the numbers you normally see, and when they report debt as a share of GDP, they compare countries to each other. Again, that is debt held by the public. For the U.S. government, a lot of debt, you know, U.S. Treasury securities is held by other elements of the government. So, for example, you might have heard of the Social Security Trust Fund. So there's things like that. So it's, yes, the Treasury has outstanding securities held by other members of the government, and so it's like the government owes itself that money. So a lot of times they net that out and they say, well, Treasury securities held by things besides the U.S. government itself. That's really the relevant figure. And so that's why that number is a little bit lower than the outstanding federal debt number. Let me throw another curveball at you folks. You might say, okay, you guys are saying some big numbers, but I've heard humongous numbers like that are, you know, $100 trillion or something, saying this is how much the government's in the hole. So what are you talking about? Well, there, that includes things like Social Security and Medicare obligations. So, for example, as of January of 2009, and I picked that number because things changed a little bit with the passage of Obamacare. They really moved numbers around and monkeyed with it. So before all that hijinks, as of January 2009, if you consulted the report from the trustees of the Social Security and Medicare funds, so this is official stuff. We'll link to it from the episode 11 of the Laura Murphy Show here, just so you guys can look at it and see. This isn't some right-wing, you know, scare tactic. This is the government's own trustee report will tell you that using a 75-year window, those programs were in the hole $46 trillion in present value terms. Okay, so what that means is they were saying the U.S. government, as of its own projections, its own trustees, actuaries, in 2009, looking forward for the next 75 years, made projections about how much our workers going to pay into Social Security and Medicare in terms of the, you know, the contributions from their paychecks, and then how much is the government going to have to pay out given the existing benefit scales for people who are eligible for Social Security and Medicare. And then they were saying there's going to be a discrepancy. That down the road, at some point, the government's going to have more payouts owed than money coming in the door from existing workers as the population shifts and there's a growing share of elderly people compared to workers. And then they said, all right, over the next 75 years, what's that gap going to be? Let's discount it to the present. What's the current present value of that? And it was, like I say, something like $46 trillion in the hole. So they would have needed $46 trillion in money right then to go invest, to start rolling over and earning interest, just so that when that 75 years was up, they could have totally broken even with how much they were going to have to pay people according to existing levels of benefits under Social Security and Medicare without having to then, you know, tap into general taxpayer funds beyond just those worker contributions. So that's what people mean. And Carlos, I know you dug up another number. So this is the government's own actuaries who, of course, are trying everything they can to make that number not so big. And you've seen, I think you got a number from a third party, that, which was much bigger.
Well, yeah, the number I saw, you said $46 trillion in what they're referring to as unfunded liabilities of the government. And I saw a number that was $120 trillion. So just a disparity there in the numbers. But the picture that we ought to be getting is that we've got a strategy in place here that's basically robbing Peter to pay Paul. Honestly, just it's that. They're robbing Peter to pay Paul. I mean, there are no funded, you know, trust funds. That's the thing. I hate to say it, but it's literally like a Ponzi scheme. And the government is like trying to keep this this facade, this illusion going. And it can get quite scary. And again, we as taxpayers are literally don't have any control over it in one sense. I mean, there's not really anything one individual can actually do to affect this strategy that is now in place. Now, there is all kinds of talk out there that is saying, you know, how much longer can we keep this up? That all this is on the verge of collapsing, because all of these bonds now, these IOUs, not only are they being bought by individuals and institutions, but they're also purchased by foreign governments. Now, that's a picture you need to see. You know, that foreign governments are buying these governments. Now, why they're doing it, you might ask, to say, why is it that they continue to look at the U.S. Treasury, which is what these bonds are, as something to buy. And on top of that, why do they place so much faith on the dollar? You know, is it because they don't realize how much debt we're in? Is it because they don't realize that we're addicted to debt? Because in a sense, this is the picture you see. And you wonder sometimes, you know, how long can this confidence last? And this is why you hear a lot of pundits, you hear even some of our people running for president are saying, hey, we've got to get this budget under control. And everybody wants to bring it under control. But how can you do this when you've got so much of these entitlement programs in place? We got so many people dependent on these entitlement programs, and there seems to be no way out. And as Bob keeps alluding to, is that the interest on these bonds is now suffocating. It's humongous. We're just paying taxes now to support the interest payments on all these bonds. Now, all the while, the cost of living is going up for us as Americans. Now, the government tells us there's no price inflation, but we all know that there is. In fact, for every dollar that we earn, you know, we're approaching having to pay back almost half of it to taxes, federal, state, and local. And so, again, this is an awful big burden on the taxpayer, for the taxpayer that is actually producing, because we have now a country in which a lot of people just are not producing.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Carlos. And it really is amazing when you think of all the different levels of taxation and things that go on. It's also including things like corporations having to pay dividend taxes and things like that when they call double taxation. Let me also just make sure people aren't getting lost here. The reason those unfunded liabilities are so high is that the government does not issue treasury securities. Okay, so that's why the government can owe, just picking round numbers here, $50 trillion right now of unfunded liabilities to perhaps not yet born Social Security and Medicare people, recipients down the road, and yet the official debt limit was only, before this last budget deal, $18.1 trillion. The reason is the official debt limit only counts to actual treasury securities that people hold, whereas if you're a Social Security beneficiary and in a sense the government owes you a bunch of money until you die, you're not sitting on actual treasury securities, but there is a sense in which you say, hey, I was paying in under these rules, and so you guys owe me this money. All right, so that's that distinction right there. Let me focus on one last thing, and then, Carlos, we should probably turn it over to solutions, because you mentioned in the beginning we wanted to give people a ray of sunshine at the end of this dismal podcast episode. The thing I want to stress is this notion people say, well, what about, you know, if we owe it to ourselves, you know, doesn't that make a distinction? So Carlos did mention of how foreigners are holding these things. I've got some figures here. As of February 2016, the biggest foreign holder was China, which had about $1.3 trillion in treasury securities. The next biggest was Japan at about $1.1 trillion. And what's interesting is those numbers are down over, depending on what you take as your baseline, from the past several months. Okay. And so I don't know if this is just a fluctuation. We would want to see longer term trends. But the point is, there are a lot of, you know, some of these big holders do seem to be reducing their outstanding holdings of treasuries. Another big holder, of course, is the U.S. Federal Reserve, is currently sitting on about $2.5 trillion of U.S. Treasury securities. And this was accumulated during those QE programs. Okay, so it's a very complicated picture, but just to see, you know, where's all this money sitting? A bunch of the treasuries are, in fact, held by U.S. corporations and households. And you don't want to be lulled into a sense of complacency, though. That doesn't reduce or eliminate the fact that that's still painful. Okay, so there is this notion going around certain circles, and Paul Krugman was emphasizing this the last couple of years, saying, oh, well, to the extent that we owe it to ourselves, the federal debt is no big deal. And that's actually a fallacy. There's one obvious thing is that to the extent that the U.S. government is running up debt, that is siphoning away savings from the private sector. And so you, other things equal, you would much rather, certainly as an Austrian economist, much rather have savings being channeled into private investment rather than going into the government's coffers, because that means ultimately future generations are going to inherit a smaller stock of actual capital, equipment, and other forms of capital if those savings have been squandered effectively by the government spending. Then there's another issue that's a little bit more complicated. I'll just put a link at the notes for this, which is episode 11 of the Laura Murphy Show, to get into some of the financing. Even beyond that direct effect I just talked about, there is a sense in which government running debt today or running deficits today can be paid for out of current saving, and then down the road, future taxpayers get born, they grow up to become workers, and they get taxed to service that debt. And so there is really a legitimate sense in which future taxpayers are toiling to pay for our profligacy today, even beyond the fact that they inherit fewer machines because we're running up debts today instead of having private investment. But that's a complicated thing. I'll put the link there at the show notes page for those who really want to get into the weeds with this stuff. With that, why don't I turn over to you, Carlos, and what do we say? People are now thoroughly depressed, and so what's the ray of hope for them?
Well, I guess the picture you should have gotten is that obviously the U.S. government needs to be able to have credit. It needs to be able to borrow. But the fear is, what happens if it can no longer borrow? And so if the U.S. Runs into a problem, it can no longer sell, its bonds, or we have people give up on its bonds, that could be a very, very serious problem for the U.S. So we also could have the failure of our money. Now, it's never really happened, in the United States, where governments have defaulted on their debts this way. However, governments defaulting is nothing new. This has happened over a period of 8 centuries. We have governments that do default, and we do have governments where their money fails. You take Greece, for example. We saw the problems that Greece was having here last year. But Greece has been in this kind of trouble 6 different times throughout history. Spain has defaulted 13 different times throughout history. The difference is it's never happened in this country, but it doesn't mean that it can't happen here. And the way the debt keeps ballooning, there is fear that, the money could go, or that our bonds could go. So what is the solution? Well, the solution that we think makes the most sense is obviously because we have to use fiat money, that's money that we don't actually own. The Federal Reserve owns it. But we still have to use fiat money in order to buy things with. And so long as we have to use that money, we want to be able to store that money in a place where we can access it whenever we need it, have fast access to that money. And we try to tell people that the best place to put that money is in a dividend-paying whole life insurance policy, because of the control you have over that money when you need it. Now, if the money goes, then we also tell folks that they should also own gold and or silver, because if the money goes, then the precious metals will be the only source of money that we'll be able to use for a while. So we tell people that everybody should own a few months worth of gold or silver in case we have the worst case scenario to happen. But so long as we're using fiat money, we are advocating that it be kept inside of a dividend paying whole life policy to use that as your personal cash flow system in order for you to have access to your money, be able to borrow at will. And that strategy, that twofold strategy, is what I would like to leave everybody with, that makes the most sense for the kind of economic environment that we find ourselves in today.
Thanks, Carlos. And for those who are just coming upon this podcast for the first time, we have elaborated on what Carlos just talked about in previous episodes. So I encourage you to peruse the archives and see if you want to learn more on any of the things he mentioned. We are over time now for this episode 11 of the Laura Murphy Show. I want to thank you for listening, and please share this podcast with others who may be interested. And remember, if you have other ideas for future topics you want Carlos and me to cover, then by all means, go ahead to the website at lauramurphy.com, and there is a little hyphen in between Laura and Murphy, and Laura is spelled L-A-R-A hyphen M-U-R-P-H-Y.com, and you'll see the contact us there, plus all kinds of other links to things that may interest you. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time.
You've just finished another episode of the Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of lauramurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.